There's been a lot of conversation in the last few years that if you do challenge yourself physically, you will not be able to maintain your progressive, liberal, left-wing politics, what have you, that by lifting weights, it turns you right-wing. I'm going to read you a quote here. It says, "Any man who improves his body through sun and steel will drift away from the modern left, a program of decrepitude and resentful monstrosity. They know this and are afraid." Does that make sense to you?
Yes, in context. In context, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Like when a kid says they see ghosts in the room, I get you. I feel you, kid.
Yeah.
Ghosts are real bad. Yeah. Here's the thing. You can steel man that. You can steel man that position. Mm-hmm. You can say that demonstrating your own internal locus of control, seeing how much you can radically improve your life just by willfully going and doing difficult things, can inoculate you at least to some contentious ideas on the extreme left, like society is wholly responsible for how you turn out. Well, God, that can't possibly be true if I could make a choice to do this or to do that. And so it can do some of that. But like, you know, the sun and steel, like what the fuck does the sun have to do with getting jacked? I don't fuck it. It's got like, it just
it's
bleeds,
from Hyperborea,
like,
I think,
yeah,
is
like
the technical
right
argument.
Right wing fucking smash the lefties, kind of like, you're like a man. Like, I get it. Nobody sucked your dick in middle school and now you're pissed about it. Like, word, man, I've been there.
Welcome to Doomscroll. I'm your host, Joshua Citarella. My guest is Dr. Mike Isratel, a PhD of sport physiology and a co-founder of Renaissance Periodization. We've been talking about the 1970s. There's an abundance of studies about declining testosterone levels, particularly in the advanced world, that they are roughly half of what the average modal man had in 1970.
The testosterone stuff mostly doesn't track if you look into the data deeply.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So one thing is like your masturbation frequency highly impacts testosterone levels as measured and sperm counts.
Okay.
And so like if you're getting it more, you're going to have slightly lower test levels, which is great.
So people are getting it more now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially in testing groups. The number one cause, as far as I understand it, for the average decline in testosterone is the increase in obesity, which predictably reduces
right.
your testosterone levels.
Right.
And so in the 70s, people just weren't as obese.
Yeah.
And then people had higher testosterone. There's also sampling issues, test fidelity issues. If you're looking for some kind of generational difference in testosterone levels that's maybe tied to sociology, you almost certainly won't find one. It's just not there. Mm-hmm. Like today's strapping young lads and just absolutely enough test way super well compared to the strapping young lads of the 1970s. The problem is 2/3 of us are not strapping young lads. We're not in great shape. That's the number one reason testosterone levels are lower. It's just straight up obesity. Obesity is not hard to explain. It never was. So if you are looking to get into best shape of your life today, you have all of the tools at your disposal. They cost almost nothing. You can be in unreal shape. In the 1970s, there were almost no books written about how to get in shape. There were almost no scientific studies about how to
get
in shape.
Did all sorts of weird stuff in
weird
the gym.
Stuff.
Yeah. Mm.
And there was no internet. So it's tough to go to a library when there are no books written about the subject functionally. And so if you wanted to get in good shape in the 70s, good luck. Hopefully you live next to Gold's Gym in Venice and sort of like wandered in there once by accident. You couldn't have Googled it either in Google Maps. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So today's empowerment to fitness is just like orders of magnitude higher than back in the day. Now, if you expect the average person to be fit just because they're empowered, that is a grotesque misrepresentation of how reality works. Mm. Because most people can be empowered to do, like, I'm empowered right now to get into fine art. Like, I have easily enough money to buy all of the you know, the surfaces on which to draw. I can buy paints. Mm. RP app's doing well. I can hire a personal coach, pretty good artist, to just get me through the watercolor spectrum and teach me how to do composition and everything.
I could probably hook you up with some people.
My man. And the thing is that you would look at my artistic proclivity and output and assess it as functionally like mentally ill and zero in that order. Okay. Like, this is a person who maybe can't see straight or something. I don't know. He has like tremors. Uh-huh. And so you say, like, what is it that is wrong with this man? What is wrong with society? And the answer is nothing. I'm just absolutely not taking any of the opportunities afforded to me to get into fine art. Like, that's the story with fitness today and testosterone levels. You can give people anything you want. If they don't use it and they just go to Taco Bell instead, you just kind of do one of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what should we make then about these narratives about endocrine disrupting chemicals, for example? Like, is it how much of declining T levels is environmental? How much of it is obesity? Is this 80-20? Or like what to what degree does EDC contribute to this problem?
Like obesity, lack of physical activity, and a few other minor variables account for like 90%+. Hmm. And endocrine disrupting chemicals currently account for a %, but that question mark is hemmed in by like less than 5 or 10.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Could be 0, could be 5 or 10%. Endocrine disrupting chemicals do not have the body of literature behind them in terms of replication of studies, scope of studies, depth of studies, in order to allow us as scientifically minded people to assess like, yes, endocrine disrupting chemicals are real. And they're having mass effects, and we know what those effects are.
Right.
Just don't know enough yet. They could mean that endocrine disrupting chemicals really are a thing, but they're probably a small thing. Now, a small but serious thing is still a serious thing. Mm. It's not going to explain the vast differences in testosterone levels. So if you have this idea of the 1970s, everything was good and great, even though we had leaded gasoline and shit, whatever, and profligate racism everywhere, fuck it. The good old days, we need those back because that's why testosterone levels are off, and endocrine disrupting chemicals is what's causing that. That's a non-starter. We know almost none of that is explained like that. The real question is, what are endocrine disrupting chemicals? Which one of these chemicals do have mass effects at a small scale? And how can we, with intelligent regulation, potentially make the trade-off of do we regulate these lower or down or out, or do we just let them go and just pay the costs on the other end? That's an open question. Yeah. Anyone in early to mid 2025 that's going to tell you they know for sure that endocrine disrupting chemicals cause mass deleterious effects and hugely responsible for, let's say, testosterone decline is probably just RFK level of make believe.
Oh, that's my next question. Don't worry, we're getting to it.
Our fearless health leader.
I'm not asking this in a political way. If you want, I'll edit this out of the podcast.
Okay.
But I imagine you're familiar with the work of Shanna Swan, who's one of the most prominent people on these questions of declining T levels, endocrine disruption, fertility crisis.
I haven't heard her name directly.
Okay. She's got a big book, Countdown. That's kind of the popular source to cite for a lot of this stuff.
Oh, okay.
She's at, UC Berkeley and Mount Sinai. Few appearances on Rogan and Huberman and these types of podcasts.
Okay.
But there's an enormous amount of conversation online about this topic specifically, and its contributions towards, for lack of a better term, emasculating the men.
Mm.
Which is why I think your perspective on this stuff is interesting, because you're like, actually, this is a small minority of what's happening.
Maybe.
And if you listen to her work, it's the entirety of the story.
Sure.
Obesity is not really mentioned, or at least not prominently mentioned.
Yeah.
Okay, but maybe I'm not going to put you in hot water, and we'll just
You can
take
put me in
snippet.
As much hot water as you like. Totally fine. Put me in hot water.
Well, I'm not
going
to ask you to debunk somebody's work that you haven't read. So that's,
definitely, I'm not
that's
capable
unfair.
Of doing that. What I do have is my own assessment of the state of literature.
Okay, so what's your assessment
of
literature?
Yeah, so the vast majority of testosterone decline is through various measurement differences. There's also some people look at raw data and they don't take demographic age differences into account. We're a much older society. So the average man is much older. And older men have lower testosterone. It's kind of crazy to bring up.
Yeah.
They really do. And then a huge rest of the fraction is made up of just people have more obesity, and that lowers testosterone levels predictably. And so that's probably most of the equation as far as I've been seeing. And then there is a conversation, a burgeoning, very interesting conversation about endocrine disrupting chemicals that still needs way more traction before we can say things super, super confidently, as far as I'm concerned, in any case. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, this is very good news because, I saw a few memes in like 2020 and I've been drinking 36 raw eggs a day ever since. So
you must just be
high anabolic diet.
Down to here, man.
On this topic of MAHA and RFK, what do you make about these conversations around seed oils?
On the one hand, potentially artificially enhanced chemicals and processed foods causing deleterious health outcomes and body composition outcomes is something we absolutely need to be looking into. And that's great that we're looking into it.
Sure, sure.
And so I don't mean to hand wave and say, seed oils. I don't need to hand wave. Because we have loads of studies by numerous institutions and private bodies, all of which, or the preponderance of which, just lead back to seed oils are totally fine in most cases. And unless you're hyper over-consuming very specific kinds of seed oils in the subcategory of seed oils, which are not great for your health in excess, then you're probably good to go and they have no effect. But the news is actually worse than this, because many seed oils, canola oil is one of them, are actually healthier for you than saturated fats. We know this from randomized controlled trials where they literally just replace your regular fats with some amount of canola oil, for example, a seed oil, and you just get healthier in kind of every measured way for weeks and weeks and weeks until the study ends. And so both from every level of analysis we have, if someone was to say, having just looked at the data, and this is an interesting thing to try with like ChatGPT's O3 reasoning model, the AI model, it'd be like, seed oils, bad for health? Because it only reads data? It'll be like, no. It would, like an alien that came down to Earth, people like, seed oils are bad, and they've read all the data because they're super smart. They'd be like, what? Why would you say that? That's a kind of strange thing to say, because it would never be apparent from mechanistic inference. It would never be apparent from actual data on consumption of different fats. Now, seed oils do happen to be in almost every single bit of junk food that you can eat. Drum roll, junk food's bad for you. No, it's fucking crazy. But we actually know that if we replace seed oil fats with other fats in junk food, the deleterious harms of junk food would just stay exactly unaltered, sometimes worse, because then you're consuming way excesses of saturated fats that are actually worse for you than seed oil. So the seed oil thing to me is a test of one of two things. One, you're just not familiar with the data and you've seen some memes, which is totally cool. That's most people on seed oils. Like, they're bad for you, right? And you're like, no, they're actually not. And they're like, get the fuck out of here. And they Google it. They're like, no, just shut the fuck up about this, because clearly I was wrong. And the other one is just like, again, this is a meme, bit of a joke, all love and respect, but just people having a lot of feelings. You know, one of my number one pieces of feedback when I often say that seed oils are not bad for your health is like, a lot of people in the comments will be like, so you're saying we have to consume industrial lubricant. That's what you want us to do. And then clever followers of mine will be like, you know, water is an industrial lubricant too, you dumb motherfucker. And they're like, and they never reply to that. Mostly they're just like, you clearly a libtard cuck or something. Oh, sweet.
What about the stuff where they say it's treated with chemicals, like there's hexane and other sorts of things in the production process?
Believe it or not, like toxicologists who get zero love, and toxicologists should get all the love in the world. It's like a profession. The only concern of a toxicologist is like, what is the environmental exposure or local exposure to toxins and how does it affect you? Almost no one ever consults them for shit, except for the federal licensing governing bodies like USDA, FDA, et cetera. Toxicologists are near unanimity of consensus that all of the treatment products, various oils approved for food, occur at such teeny, teeny levels as absolutely no detectable or theoretical impact on health and wellness of your body when you consume them. And if you're looking at impacts and chemicals and shit like that, I think people think like when they learn something from a meme, they're like the first person to figure it out. Like, did you know companies put hexane in their shit? Like, holy fuck. Someone's got to tell the FDA. And you call the FDA. They're like, yeah, no shit, dummy. This has been something we've been doing for 40 years and it's super healthy and safe. You're like, right, I wasn't the first person to this. And so it turns out almost all of our food supply is really healthy, really safe, except if you overeat radical amounts of junk food, which by the way, 2/3 of Americans do. Replacing high fructose corn syrups with cane sugar, which is an RFK idea, has been shown in multiple randomized controls trials and huge meta-analyses to have absolutely zero effect on health. Seed oils, same thing. People are looking for one fucking thing to blame.
Right.
They're looking for one little ingredient that's going to unhack their whole life. But you're still ordering fries from Grubhub at 4 a.m, huh, pimp? Dope. There's nothing that's going to get you out of that shit.
A few other topics on this. They're kind of all lumped in together here, but one of the things people say about the seed oils is that animal fats, high fat diets, high cholesterol diets are more anabolic. Cholesterol is a building block for testosterone, and seed oils are reducing your T levels. Is there any connection there?
Seed oils reducing T levels, I've never seen any convincing data on. I think that's probably make-believe. Your cholesterol production is almost entirely endogenous. And so external cholesterol, if you eat very low fats and very low cholesterol, you might have a problem. Some people don't. If you eat just enough, you're totally good. Anything more than that is extra and just causes bad health outcomes. So protein, really good to eat. Enough carbs to give you energy and enough fats to keep you full in your hormones, which is not that many fats. You can eat substantially more fats and fewer carbs. That's a balance you can have yourself. But the idea that if you just really eat a ton of fats and tons of cholesterol, you're somehow going to be super steroid man is total fucking bullshit. I wouldn't have to inject every day if that was the case. So yeah, unfortunately, fortunately or not, that's not the way it works.
Hmm. What about height day?
What?
Have you ever done height day?
Height day?
Yeah. There's, speaking of scientific expertise, there's a meme on 4chan that if you're between the ages of like 16 and 17 before your ephesial plates have sealed, that you can do probably for the length of like 45 minutes, weighted hangs to elongate your spine like a medieval rack. And you can gain like a half inch to an inch of height.
Two things. I have not directly looked at such claims. So I'm speaking from considerable ignorance. Number two, to the degree that I've ever looked into it, height modulation is only possible through adequate nutrition in childhood. Mm-hmm. Anything downstream of that is kind of irrelevant. I think it's, I'm going to use 4chan nomenclature, incel cope, short king coping, you know, like, which I am a fucking, I'm 5'1". And so, you know, like there's, I wish it was true. It could be true at the margins. I doubt it. I'm speaking outside of my area of direct knowledge, but I would ask ChatGPT that question. The results would probably be disappointing. Otherwise I need a time machine to make myself taller.
I've heard you talk before about growing up in the Soviet Union. You had, I believe, a black and white TV in 1991?
Correct, with two channels.
Could you give us some of the background of that experience and how it informed your political views now?
I don't know how much it informed my political views. Okay, so I was born in 1984 in Moscow, Russia, and my parents and my sister and grandma and I emigrated to the United States in 1991. Mm-hmm. So the first 7 years of my life, I do have memories of the Soviet Union. Most of my memories of childhood are very idyllic and amazing. Some of my memories are incongruent with most experiences that people have in the United States and thus can be juxtaposed as like, whoa, that's fucked.
How so?
Like overt racial discrimination at my preschool.
Mm.
Like in America, that would be considered like on the nightly news for a year straight if that happened. In the Soviet Union, it was just normal. So like I was called like various terminology for Jew that I can't say on this podcast.
We are on
to
YouTube.
My face.
Thank you.
At
I appreciate
age four.
That. Yep.
Yeah. And so that's cool. That's interesting. I remember one time, my parents sort of found out how much money we had or something. And I remember saying something about it in an elevator and my parents got really hush hush and really upset. And they told me later that you cannot tell anyone how much money we make or how much money we have. Like, we were like the equivalent of roughly middle class, maybe upper middle, because we lived in Moscow.
Yeah.
I remember being like, well, why? And they sort of had to explain to me, like, I know, not so many years ago in our country, if people found out you had more money, the state would come for you because people would rat you out. And so that's kind of weird. It's nothing you would ever really experience in the United States to that extent. So a few of those things. I remember when we were leaving, people at customs tore up our Soviet passports because we were disgracing the Soviet Union by leaving. And they also robbed all of us. I didn't have any jewelry on me, but they robbed my parents of all of their precious possessions right then and there before we left.
Yeah.
And so there are, you know, a variety of other memories that I have that are kind of like, yeah, man, communism's the real deal. I remember physically standing in bread lines with my parents. I remember, my parents had my dad had a really cozy relationship with some of the people that did like sliced meat at the store. And there was like a basement you can go into where they would undercut the prices a little bit. And I was like five and I was like, Dad, when are we going to the basement? Shut the fuck up. And then we'd go down there. You're not supposed to be going down there, but everything was under the table. Mm-hmm. And there was a clear understanding in the air that like anything you wanted done for real, you couldn't go through proper channels. It was just a dead end. I also have explicit visual memories of the grocery store. It was called Diet. how communist, very straightforward. And I remember like most times, the shelves were mostly empty.
Mm.
Like I just thought that's how shelves worked. And when we came to America and saw the grocery store here, we were just like completely blown away. There was a variety of categories of food that I just didn't even know existed. Mm. And still to this day don't, because you can't, if you eat a new food every day at like Wegmans or something, you'll die before you get through all the new foods, right?
Sure.
So that was a huge, huge shock. We used in 1991, we were using powdered toothpaste still.
Right.
In the wealthiest city in the Soviet Union, shit like that. But as far as my political views, I would say that by the time I was in 10th grade, I had begun to read a little bit. I remember taking the diamond-shaped political quiz, and I was...
No fucking way, really?
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, world's smallest political quiz?
Yes, yes.
Hell yeah.
And okay. I scored as left-leaning totalitarian. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So any idea about how my experience...
I was not expecting
Yeah, sure. And I'll tell you exactly why I did. Basically, the quiz they gave us, the test they gave us was like, you know, here are various problems of society. How much do you think the government should be thinking about solving them? I think libertarians say not at all, but totalitarians say all of it. And so I both cared for my fellow man, as I still do, and also wanted all the problems solved, as I still do. And that scored me right into the left totalitarian.
Wow.
Only later, when I read Actual Economics, did I realize that the intention to cure all of society's ills through government really doesn't work as well as you would think. And there are much better ways to solve it that economists have discovered. So I can't even really say that any story that would say because of my experience in the Soviet Union that categorically made me pro-capitalist and anti-communist would be a... It would be a stretch. There's probably elements of that that are true, but it just doesn't map one-to-one. Because again, I was an ardent left of, considerably left of center and very totalitarian through most of my youth.
I promise I am bringing us to a certain point in this conversation,
no,
but I have to take this
scenic route. Sure.
So the world's smallest political quiz, which is what you took, this diamond shape.
Some variation of it.
It's rotated 45 degrees. Now we call it the political compass. It is invented in, I believe, 1971 by David Nolan, who later in 1972 becomes one of the founders of the United States Libertarian Party.
Interesting.
The largest, most prominent, I think, well-founded critique of the smallest political quiz and the political compass in general is that it has a right libertarian bias, and very few people score in the upper left-hand quadrant, which means you must have been a very based Stalinist. To like actually get the metrics that put you up there,
because
the whole test, like, it kind of skews you towards the lower libertarian corner.
Oh, interesting.
Because that's the ideological bias of the guy who made it.
I read it backwards.
So it's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I've done a lot of interviews. I have not heard that one before. So congratulations.
Oh, geez. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know.
No, it's good. It's good. It's that's what we're doing here.
We want
the most interesting stuff to come
out.
I wanted to take us down this route because I know that previously, I'm not sure currently, but at least in your past, you were an avid reader of Ayn Rand. You have two tattoos, I believe, on your shoulders.
Yes, correct.
A dollar sign and a gear. I want to ask you about Ayn Rand and the significance of those two symbols.
Yeah.
For people who aren't familiar, Ayn Rand made a similar trajectory of coming from the failing Soviet Union to the United States and is one of the people who kind of, you know, regales the triumph of American capitalism.
Yeah. So I was forced to read Ayn Rand, forced is a very loose term here, in 11th grade English class in the United States.
It was on the curriculum.
On the reading list, on the curriculum. It was not optional. And so we read The Fountainhead.
Yeah.
Which I considered a little bit of two things. One was I was like, whoa, this, some elements of this are describing more about how I think about the world and see the world than any human I have ever talked to, any book I have ever read. Like, I think Howard Roark is like, the way she describes him, like standing on a cliff before he jumps into the water. And like the first scene, I was like, what the fuck? This is unbelievable. I thought I was misreading. I was like, there's no way this person really means these things. And then later she did. And I was like, holy shit. And the other way I understood at the time was that this was a book and perhaps a philosophy that was totally bereft of nuance, almost in its entirety. For example, there was not a single child, as far as I can remember, in fucking any of the books. People did not engage in practices that looked anything like breeding or rearing families. So that's odd. Does she have an explanation for how and why that should work? Not really. And so I was like, this is a very small slice of the pie, but a very interesting slice of the pie. And then later I read Atlas Shrugged.
Right.
And I didn't read it. I listened to it on audiobook. I believe it was the abridged version, as shameful as that should be. And my friends have never let that one down, to their credit, of course. And I remember one of the passages in which, you know, there's this, Hank Reardon was the guy that's made this new kind of steel, and he had a bridge erected, a contract for a bridge, and they were riding a train over this bridge over a ravine for the first time ever. And pretty much everything I'd seen so far in Hollywood and main literary kind of output was like, you know, anytime someone competent and powerful and thinks they're correct tries to do something, they fail grandiosely in many cases. And they learn a lesson about humility or about, you can't just be number one. And I remember when I was listening to the passage in which she describes that the train didn't even seemingly touch the tracks. It just soared over them. Like the metal worked that well. I cried fucking tears while driving. Mm. Other highway people must have been like, the fuck's wrong with that guy? Many things I can say. But I was like, oh my God, someone's really leaning into capability. Leaning into that if you align your variables properly and work really hard, you can win, period. Not win with an asterisk, not but, there's a lesson, just fucking win. And I don't mean win against other people. I mean win against entropy, win against chaos, win against being able to not do things. And I was like, thought that was so life-affirming. And then the rest of Atlas Shrugged was really just kind of super baller. And I think makes a much better political point than The Fountainhead, which honestly, architecture, I could give a flying fuck about. I think it's beautiful, but I have no... serious aesthetic to architecture or attachments to anything. But Atlas Shrugged, I was like, whoa, this is really legit. Of course, very little nuance, very little inclusion of a massive scope of how society should work. But to the extent that she was making a certain point, and I think the point is that you can dog on raw capability as much as you like until you need it. And then you're going to come crawling back to the people that can do shit instead of the people that feel entitled to the output of people that can do shit. And I thought that was brilliant. It was wonderful. And then I read another book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, more of a technical work. And I remember just the cover had the gear on it, a person putting up a gear. And I was like, that is going right on my body. And then Atlas Shrugged, I have a dollar sign. I forget which one's on which side. And so that was, to me, Ayn Rand is, to me, much less of a, much less of a fronting of technical benefits of capitalism and much more of the maybe first person that described the spiritual upsides of capitalism, of which I think there's always a good time to talk about the spiritual uplift of capitalism, because I think that the benefits and wonders of capitalism are like almost never discussed. And the even people who are pro-capitalism consider them shameful and don't want to talk about it. But just wonderful that somebody said all these things. Like, you know what? Fuck that. Yeah, ability is awesome. You want to be abled. You want to produce mega value, and the production of wealth is way more important than how it is distributed. I think that was dope.
Remind me again, this the book with the gear on the cover.
Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal.
Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. The gear is quite an interesting choice because it's often a symbol of socialism. It's a symbol of the industrial workers.
Right.
And so I thought when I first saw these tattoos that it was kind of a pairing of like this left-right dichotomy on either arm.
Very interesting.
Yeah. But I guess I just misinterpreted it. To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon. Well, when I reached out to you, there has been a preponderance, an abundance of think pieces in mainstream media and reputable publications that lifting weights somehow turns people right wing, turns them into a fascist. Have you seen people over the last, let's say, decade of time who are very into exercise, bodybuilding specifically, that have turned super right wing? Is there any truth, any credibility to this narrative?
This is a great question. It's good. It's very complicated to figure out what's going on without delving really deep into data that doesn't exist, because we don't have like control trials of this kind of stuff. Like, you're going to lift with zero exposure to the internet. You're going to get to do Hitler memes all day long. Couple of things I suspect are going on. One is that hardcore lifting is a predominantly male demographic orientation. Males tend to be statistically overrepresented in right-leaning politics, underrepresented in left-leaning politics, females vice versa. This is especially true now with younger people, way more than ever over the last 50 years of measurement. So today, 20-something-year-old males are significantly more right-leaning than usual. 20-something-year-old females are significantly more left-leaning than usual. But just because you take a slice of fitness, which is already male-dominated in some respect, hardcore fitness, very male-dominated, you're just going to find a lot of people who are proto-fascists because like the extreme right has proto-fascists, just like the extreme left has proto-communists. So one, I think the probably the biggest factor I would say suspect is just the demographic slicing. It's like finding radical people in the Black Panther Party. Like they're in this for a reason, right? And so that's number one. Number two, it's absolutely not clear to me that fitness involvement exaggerates your degree of right-leaning proclivity, though I can subsume like maybe a few mechanisms by which it could. One of that is people who tend to get really hardcore into fitness, not always, but sometimes feel a bit of a deficit in their own internal locus of control, their own power, their own strength, their own ability to affect the world and feel confident in it. And they also feel like maybe they're lacking something. And a lot of times, especially males that prefer an internal locus of control, they do this thing where they will blame people for their maladies. So if you're having a real bad day as someone on the more far right, just inherently as a far right thinker, you walk outside and you see homeless people, you see out of shape people, you see people that are unattractive, you think that's all dirty and disgusting and gross, and you hate it. And you hate deeply that parts of you reflect that as well, parts you would like to change, parts you're busy changing with fitness, which is a great thing. But then all of that stuff hits you and it makes you lean even further right, because your disgust with the world basically prompts you to try to organize the world with a very strong hand and to kind of exert far right political control to clean up everything that you see wrong. So people that see something fixable within themselves oftentimes go to trying to fixing it with left-leaning things. You'll see that with lots of females and some males. You'll see that with lots of extreme fitness males. Like, something should be done about this. Like, we need people to be forced to exercise. You know, crazy-ass right-wing shit like that. So I think that's a part of it. And I think also that when you lift and diet well, you realize that for essentially, because information is currently almost free at this level, like ChatGPT is free and you can just ask it for any workout advice, it'll give you everything. Eating well, if again, you talk to ChatGPT and you're like, how can I eat well for super cheap? You'll discover quickly that healthy eating is actually fundamentally cheaper than eating any kind of processed food or anything like that and eating unhealthy. And you also discover that for whatever $10 or $25 a month at Planet Fitness, you can, there's very little money to actually like do your fitness thing. And you see a radical transformation in your own mindset, in your own physique, in your own health, in how people treat you and how you treat yourself. And so a lesson you may learn from this is that, man, like really one of the number one reasons why people, some people have less than and others have more than, is because those less than people haven't upgraded themselves enough. And they really just lack the number one requirement. It's not money. It's not opportunity. Like, everyone has gyms now. Everyone has great food almost. And you say, okay, it's a willpower thing. And that's right into right-wing politics. Mm-hmm. So I think some people can learn that their experience to fitness affirms kind of a right-wing narrative. It's really, it's also like, you know, like fuck the billionaires, take their money. Okay, cool. But if you're out of shape, how do you take someone else's shape? You can't. Is actually the only way to get in shape really is to just pound in the hard work yourself.
You can't redistribute the gains.
You can't redistribute the gains. Hashtag redistribute the gains. You'll pry them off my cold, dead hands. But basically, I think a lot of people take that internal locus of control, that reaffirmation of willful, kind of consistent effort, totally unmoored from any kind of external assistance, can radically upgrade their life in such a big extent, they start looking at poverty and crime and other things and being like, these people just need to get their act together, which is a classically right-wing view. I think that's how it works. What I will say is I find no evidence for, pretty much, is that somehow the average fitness industry hardcore person, like, you know, you're lifting and you're doing leg presses, he's like, yeah, it's a good set. You're like, thanks, mister, you have big quads. He's like, I know, man. You want to vote for Tucker Carlson 2028? And you're like, well, gee whiz, mister, I'll sure look into that. I think it's pretty much almost never happens. The vast majority of hardcore lifters, and I mean vast, are just totally apolitical. For one real simple answer, almost all Americans are apolitical. Like, one of the reasons that politics has been drifting apart left and right is because the proportion of people voting keeps going like this. It's like, you know, those kids in high school that were really into civics class. You're like, who the fuck? Do you not have any friends or some shit? I think that's how most Americans see politics. And so quite honestly, when people say there's like a really nasty hard right trend in hardcore fitness, I mean, you talk to most of my bodybuilding and powerlifting friends and be, what do you think about politics? And be like, what? I don't. Right, they have no political opinions whatsoever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there also a genetic component that with the explicit discussion of your genetic ceiling, so, you know, how far you can progress in terms of building muscle, that by nature of having that in the conversation, conversations just generally lead toward things like genetic superiority to some degree?
I see the number of conversations I've heard segue from genetic superiority in the realm of lifting to genetic superiority as a way to stack different ethnicities of humans and decide who gets to have full civil rights and who gets to go to the death camps is approximately zero. But I can totally see how a pretending that genetics do not matter, or genetics are just like super randomly varied and no racial or ethnic groups have superiority in one condition or the other, I can see that you could be very dissuaded from that by experiencing both your own progress and the progress of people around you. I mean, there are people that will show up to the gym who don't lift, who look like they've been lifting for 20 years. Yeah. There are people who lift for 20 years that look like they've never lifted, and every single thing in between. And it becomes very apparent once you lock your diet down, your training down, your consistency down, your sleep down, that roughly the only remaining variable is genetics multiplied by time. And so because time is a thing that tracks very easily on a calendar, you're really measuring genetics at that point. And so you can tell what kind of genetics you have, and you can tell people around you what kind of genetics they have. And so if someone tells you like, well, genetics don't matter, and then you know you have a Nigerian friend, an Indian friend, and a Jewish friend, and a white friend, and all friends at the gym, you're going to be like, oh, don't they matter though? And then, you know, some people will take that to its unfortunate non-conclusions, which is we have to hurt certain groups of people or prevent them from having civil rights, which is a huge non sequitur, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, this is kind of a perfect setup for how I've been thinking about this topic, because you go into something that's a hobby, it's a leisure activity. Some people do it professionally, but not most. And you are kind of forced to consider the degrees to which human beings are different. And one is tempted to say that from that experience, you would extrapolate out a politics of, well, humans are different, there are different hierarchies in society, and so the cruelties of contemporary society are then justified based on those differences. But bodybuilders also intervene upon their natural state.
Yeah.
They improve themselves, enhance themselves, I believe is the term,
yes,
through science and technology.
Yeah.
And what I have not heard discussed, because that is, I mean, I think an industry standard at the competitive, the highest end of it, to what degree does it then logically follow that one would use science and technology to intervene upon the hierarchies and the differences in outcomes in society?
Oh, that's bold. So basically, what you're saying is, if we know that good nutrition, good sleep, good training, as provided to you by somebody else, like a coach or a trainer or a community, if they're really amazing at sort of uplifting, no matter what genetics you have, they're really amazing at uplifting your results, wouldn't that also lead you to conclude that government intervention programs to do the same in society, not for fitness, but for every other quality, would also kind of lift everyone up? And I think you get two potentialities from that. One is you could definitely conclude that, absolutely, if you're into that sort of thing. The other is you tend to notice something in bodybuilding and just in fitness hardcore, and that's pretty much everyone has access to all that stuff, and a vast majority of people just barely use it. And some people just stick to their own stupid bullshit and ignore science and ignore all these wonderful advances because they just kind of know what they know. And so that could lead you to the opposite conclusion, that if we were, for example, like let's say you were to give every person in just the most degenerate, derelict hood or trailer park in America, like $20,000 a year, right? Universal basic income experiment. What is the probability that the vast majority of those people would use it to enhance their net good in society, their own net good, and their how much of that would be spent on education, healthy food, proper childcare, et cetera? Some, for sure, some. How much of it would be spent on the same shit a lot of those people usually spend money on? Drugs, tasty food that you can have now, gambling, et cetera. A lot? And so you could say, well, you know, if everyone has access to good nutrition, almost everyone, good training science, and all these other opportunities, but so few people take them, they're free. There's literally just come and get them. Almost no one cares. Maybe that's an argument against the UBI in some sense, very extrapolatory argument. They're saying, look, if we just give a bunch of people who already spend their money like shit more money, they'll probably just spend it like shit. And then we'll just be out $20,000.
People do argue that. They also argue it in the opposite direction, that the kind of Milton Friedman type people will say that actually we should eliminate the kind of social democratic welfare state. We should eliminate those universal programs, give people the UBI to demonstrate that they spend it in non-productive ways, that they spend it on gambling and bad food and things like that.
Yikes.
On a more serious note, in your conversation with Destiny, you said, I'm going to read the quote here, "I think governments should be run by corporations, top to bottom, full send. The deliverable of the corporation is standard of living and justice. The payment you give is taxes." Are you familiar with the concept of a sov corp?
Mm-hmm.
Would you explain this idea further? How do you envision this thing manifesting in reality?
Manifesting in reality is tough because any kind of reality has to follow a political process,
right,
in which people request things like that. But I'll give you a bit of a sample. I'd say if a jurisdiction in the United States, let's say a city or a county of some decent size, decided it was going to be run by a corporation, and it was full send, local level, all decisions are made at corporate level, and the outcomes, you know, let's say also, I think practically, the corporation is run with, in huge part, by artificial superintelligence, which I think is imminent. And so artificial superintelligence running a for-profit system where its benefits is that you pay it, and the benefits it gives you out is it organizes society really well so you can succeed and yourself benefit. I think like a small jurisdiction like that, like a city or something, a county, can start to show just like really awesome outcomes compared to all other places. All of a sudden someone's like, hey, like heard you're moving to Atlanta. You're like, actually it's a suburb of Atlanta. You're like, why not the other place? You're like, oh, well, their taxes are lower and the streets are cleaner and they have basically no crime and I love it. It's great. Like tons of restaurants and bars and clubs and everyone's great. You're like, oh, holy shit. So like, what kind of like the Democrat, Republican? They're like, nah, it's a corporation. And like, well, aren't you worried about that? They're like, well, look, I'm not so sure they can violate my civil rights at will. So like, pretty good to me. Everything's fine. You get enough of stories like that, then it's like an alternative. So we have like government run high level of economic control, government run low level of economic control, like a different economic index of freedom. And then you have a third option, which is like corporate jurisdiction. And we'll see how the corporations do. I'll say the corporations and everything they've ever tried to do writ large, they do it better than government by like almost incalculable orders of magnitude. I'd say like give a shot at the title to corporations to run the government. They probably do a better job than government will. Yeah.
Have you come across the work of Albert Hirschman? Exit, Voice, and Loyalty?
No, but that sounds familiar.
He proposes a kind of similar thought experiment, but essentially if you don't like the sovereignty you're under, you can exit. And the alternative to that is something called voice, which is democratic inputs. In this proposed model, to what degree would you have democratic inputs like voting and so on?
I think you would probably have minimal voting. You don't currently vote for much in a corporation. Like, so I'm under the dark realm of Spotify for my music preferences. And I don't vote dick on Spotify. I don't vote for anything. But the corporation seems to always know what I want really goddamn well and offer me incredible value for low prices. Mm-hmm. But Spotify has one thing they really fear is just me leaving the platform. I just don't want my music here anymore because like Apple Podcasts or Music or some shit just did a better job. And so all of a sudden you have the situation where if you assume that voluntary movement, and immigration is possible, then governments of any structure whatsoever have to compete for people. And if that's a real thing, and if people are free to move or free to associate with one jurisdiction or not, then you have the two basic ingredients, like different kinds of ways of doing things and people vote with their feet, you got a winning proposition. If people vote democratically, then it's like ends up being, you might have a consensus government where it's a 95-5 requirement. You might have a majoritarian government where it's a 50-50 requirement or 50-51-49. And then a lot of people have to compromise, whereas they otherwise wouldn't. Like, there's so many places to live in the world. I'd say it's really cool to just like let places try different things. And then if you don't like a place, you just fucking leave. Or you can leave in like financial sense. Like it's just like, oh, my shit is somewhere else financially. I don't fuck with this anymore. I think that just promotes incredible things because people voting with their feet is the ultimate demonstration. Because you can talk a lot of shit about liking a place and not liking a place. But so far, when there used to be a border between China and Hong Kong, I don't know if this is one person has ever like swam across to get to China, but sure, shit, a lot of people come to Hong Kong. And that's true for almost every illiberal place and liberal place in the world. So people just like liberty a whole lot. And if you vote with your feet, so to speak, in the corporate world or whatever other world we're talking about, whoever runs the government, that is quintessential. Secondary to that, massively uninhibited immigration, legal uninhibited immigration is like such a net positive to the world at large if it's accepted that it's like it's a huge, huge win. So I think immigration is just like a wonderful, wonderful thing.
What are the limits of personal responsibility?
The limits of personal responsibility. I think a big limit of personal responsibility is assuming that everyone is capable of the same degree of effect of personal responsibility on their lives. If you are mentally not as healthy as you could be, if you are not as educated as you could be, if you are not as intelligent from whatever combination of genetic and environmental factors, if you come from a culture which has not adequately prepared you for an internal locus of control, long-time horizon thinking, conscientiousness, it's simply unrealistic for us to expect that you will exert your personal responsibility in a very effectual way. How important is safety? Very. How safe are 8-year-olds playing just by themselves with no supervision? And then you're like, well, safety's the problem. No. 8-year-olds are the fucking problem. And they're not a problem. They're just very limited in their ability to assess their environment and actions for safety. And so when you say, America should be based on personal responsibility, I can't agree with that anymore. Personal responsibility is a thing that we want as much of as possible. But when some people are subjected to a regime in which personal responsibility is the onus on which they can produce their life's outcome, and they fail to produce a good outcome, we have to be like, okay, personal responsibility is great, but some people need more help than others. And that's a big part of my political philosophy that intersects a ton with the left. Like, for example, homelessness, huge, huge pet topic of mine. The vast majority of people who are homeless are a combination of just two things. Three, addicted to drugs, mentally ill, usually drug addiction is to self-treat mental illness, and profoundly low IQ, like not intelligent enough to operate well in the world. Like if you took the average 12-year-old, you're like, now you have a career in banking, hit it. You'd be like, the fuck, I don't know, this makes sense. And he would be homeless. Most 12-year-olds would be fucking homeless. And they're not even like mentally ill. They're just not smart enough to operate in the world. When I was 12, I didn't know which way was up and down. I can't operate a checkbook. And so because we know that most homelessness is a result basically of mental illness and insufficient intelligence, Greta Thunberg moment incoming. How dare we, right? Let these people live in the fucking street. Jesus Christ, do we live in a sensible, moral, modern, compassionate society or not? Why aren't we pulling these people off the street and helping them? And you say, how do we help them? Treat them for their mental health disorders and give them many forms of assistance, including assisted living, so that they can have awesome lives and be able to get by with an IQ of 65. There's loads of these people, that's most homeless people, but we're letting them out there because their personal responsibility, the way I get it, they're unable to be sufficiently responsible to cause a good outcome. They're not necessarily bad people. They're not trying to fuck up your commute by lying in the middle of the sidewalk. They're desperately in need of help. And so I think the political left, Anytime, a little bit of a passion thing, anytime leftists get to clap in their mouths about how shit the Midwest is, dumbass Republicans and how amazing the cities are, I go to New York and I'm like, what the fuck is that? Why is this person in the street? And they go, well, it's not our, all of a sudden they get weirdly libertarian. Like, well, we can't pull them off the street. Like, I'm sorry. Can you imagine doing that to a child? 8-year-old girl with a little dress, it's got stains on it. And she's just standing in the middle of fucking Times Square. And you're like, if we have a child protective services worker come put this person in a place with a warm bed, caring people and food and a school, like, no, we got to leave her alone. What the fuck? So personal responsibility is awesome, but some people, it's just not enough for them. We need to help those people desperately. It may be one of the core functions of either government or civil society. I don't see it, man. I don't see it. I see a lot of people just being like, I don't live in this area. I'm just going to go like this. I'm going to get to work and do my finance capitalism stuff. I'm going to step over homeless people on the train. Then I get to Brooklyn, the nice part, and I don't have to fucking look at it anymore. I think that's fucking wild.
Dr. Mike Isertel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon.